Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. In this episode, we'll feature an excerpt of a recent roundtable about Chicago police torture with a group of Chicago political activists and relatives of torture victims. But now, a collection of recent news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes, recorded on December 24th, 2010.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
This week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to approve new rules for the Internet. The rules were intended to keep users and innovators free from discrimination by Internet service providers like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. Instead, they leave consumers with minimal online protections. Craig Aaron is the managing director of Free Press. He says the new rules just aren't good enough.
I think the biggest problem with these rules, and there are a few good things in them, but overall they're very problematic, and the biggest problem is that it simply doesn't protect wireless internet users. So those who are connecting to the internet with a mobile phone or an iPad or another mobile device, the FCC has basically endorsed discrimination. They've given permission to AT&T and Verizon to discriminate, to pick and choose which websites and services are going to work and which maybe won't work so well.
The FCC rules pave the way for a closed system on the wireless web, where the big media companies could dictate how you use the internet on your mobile device. And there are big loopholes in the rules that allow the big companies and their legions of lawyers to wiggle through and charge users more for less.
We had hoped for a prohibition against what's called paid prioritization. There's some language discouraging paid prioritization, which is this ability of companies to set up toll roads where they'll speed up their service but slow down everybody else. But there's not a strict prohibition. There's not clear language against specialized or managed services, which would be a whole separate lane, not even on the internet, where companies could build new products and things and stop investing in the open internet.
Free Press will be closely examining the rules and exploring options to improve them and to ensure rigorous enforcement of the few protections that are in place. Efforts will be redoubled to bring pressure to the FCC and Congress to create rules that reflect the public interest rather than the corporate interest.
It's not real net neutrality, and that means that our fight is going to have to continue until we really secure the protections we need to make sure the free and open internet stays that way.
For more information about the fight for net neutrality, go to savetheinternet.com.
And now a special commentary from me, your host, Candace Clement. 2010 draws to a close with a decisive victory in a 10-year struggle for communities looking to grab a slice of the local airwaves. In the 11th hour of the 111th Congress, the Local Community Radio Act sailed through the House and the Senate. The bill will open up hundreds of new potential frequencies for licensing low-power FM radio stations. LPFMs are non-commercial, hyper-local radio stations that will be run by nonprofits like community groups, churches, and schools. Because they are so locally oriented, the programming is as diverse as the communities they serve. Tens of thousands of activists and supporters contacted Congress to demand more local radio in our communities. This Herculean effect would not have been possible without the tireless work of the Prometheus Radio Project and countless other organizations and individuals who have been so involved in shepherding this bill to passage. What the bill does is very simple. It removes previous restrictions on the licensing of tiny local radio stations. But by getting this one change on the books, the effects will be massive. Hundreds, potentially thousands of new stations can take to the airwaves. Whether those stations are breaking up the monotony of the FM dial by playing something other than the same old Top 40s format, or are licensed to immigrant communities who are eager to get their own slice of the airwaves to speak to each other in their own language, this bill will change things. I got involved in media reform after working with my own local LPFM station. As a faithful supporter of free speech and diversity of views, arts, and culture, community radio was like a dream come true. I met people I never would have crossed paths with if it weren't for the station. It made me understand where I lived, the challenges we have to overcome together, and the great things happening around me in a way I hadn't before. I've been fortunate enough to work the last 4 years alongside incredible organizers, radio technicians, community media enthusiasts, and policy experts who have been fighting to pass this bill for a decade. And here is a victory that shows the kind of impact fighting for better media policy can have. While it's hard to have such a huge victory followed up only days later with a disappointing outcome on another critical media issue, net neutrality, it should point to what is possible. It took 10 years to win this fight for more local radio, and we need it now more than ever before. When we are organized, we can beat the odds and we can win. So now let's take to the airwaves and keep fighting for more diverse, democratic, and open media.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature an excerpt of a recent roundtable about Chicago police torture with a group of Chicago political activists and relatives of torture victims. The roundtable was recorded on Sunday, January 9, 2011, and offered commentary related to the January 2011 sentencing of former Chicago police officer and convicted torturer John Burge and related issues. The following excerpt featured two community activists, Tamika Irby and Mark Clements, and two relatives of torture victims, Armanda Shackelford and Michelle Martin Howard. Can you please introduce yourself?
My name is Armanda Shackelford.
And you have a relative who is in prison?
Yes.
What is this person's name?
Gerald Reed.
What did Gerald do to merit a prison sentence?
He was arrested for two counts of murder.
When did this happen?
If I'm not mistaken, it was October of 1990.
So he's been in jail since then?
Yes.
Approaching now 20 years, more than.
Yes. Okay.
Has he been connected at all with John Burge?
Torture, yes.
He's been tortured?
Yes.
Please explain a little bit more about the circumstances of his torture, if you could please.
The night he was arrested, my son Gerald had gotten shot years ago before this incident happened. Mm-hmm. And he got shot in his right leg and the right knee. To put that leg back together, they ran a pin through that leg. The night he was arrested and tortured, they broke that pin in that knee. And as of right now, he's having a lot of problems. He's in a lot of pain.
So Gerald had an incident. He had fractured his knee.
Okay.
So in fracturing his knee, he needs a pin to hold it. But that's not all for Gerald Reed. My name is Tamika Irby. I'm a community mm-hmm. activist. With the Jail John Burge Coalition and other organizations, Campaign to End the Death Penalty and National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. Mm-hmm. But what happened with Gerald's case was that the police held him for days. They held him for days with allegedly he murdered two individuals. Okay, so they tried to force him into a false confession, wrote out the confession. He refused to sign the confession. They kept him for days, and essentially, they took him for a ride. They took him for a ride in some community that he didn't know where he was at, and took him out the car and told him, "You can go."
And this was all in 1990 when this happened?
Exactly.
Okay.
This was in October, I believe it was like October 5th, something like that, of 1990. Okay, so what happened was after they told him he can go, get out the car in the back of some dark alley, he was scared to run. He thought that they were gonna shoot him in the back. Okay, so what happened was he refused to get out the car. So they pulled him out the car, they put a gun to his head, and told him, if you don't sign this confession, we're going to kill you. Mm-hmm. So with the gun to your head, you're being held for, I think he was being held for, that was 3 days at this point, or 2 days. 2.5 days, I'm sorry. And you're scared. You don't know what's going on. Why are these police officers, why are these detectives taking me into this dark alley? And they already done beat you. They beat him until they broke the pin in his leg. Mm-hmm. And then they put a gun to his head in the back of an alley and forced him to sign a confession. If you have a gun to your head and you already know that these detectives, these cops are crooked because they already tortured you, and that you're taken in the back of an alley and you're being placed the gun to your head, then of course you're going to sign that confession. And this is like, these are known tactics that they have done. Mm-hmm. Chicago Police Department, John Burge, his command, his other comrades. You know, this is the type of stuff that gets me involved. This is the type of stuff that gets Bertha, Michelle, Mrs. Shackelford, Mark, Mike Elliott, this Ted Pearson. This is the type of stuff that gets us involved because this is an outrageous act against humanity.
The names you had just mentioned are people who have also either been themselves torture victims or relatives of torture victims under the police.
They're relatives, they're activists, mm-hmm. they're relatives and activists.
And they're upstanding citizens going on with their respective lives, and suddenly they have their lives shattered by an entity that you figure is supposed to obey the law, but seems like is abusing its authority.
Exactly. I mean, I could go on and talk about how John Burge and those under his command tortured a 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, how can you, and when I say torture, I don't mean just like only beating. I don't mean like punching him in the stomach or slapping him in the face. I mean pulling out that shock box, putting his hands, a 13-year-old boy hands into a shock box.
Pardon me for asking, what's a shock box?
Shock box is something that apparently Burge brought over from the Vietnam War that he was serving. He would have alligator clips and connected to the ears, to the nipples. Also stick these clips to their hands, their fingers, and send electric shocks through their body.
Alligator clips apparently connected by some wiring to some electrical device.
Exactly.
That was solely for, you know, torturing by use of electricity.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, the whole thing is with Marcus Wiggins, this kid was 13 years old. He thought that he was going to die. It's in the documents. His hands began to burn. His jaws began to sink in. And it's just ridiculous.
I'd like to explore a little bit more about why you think this has been happening. I mean, what seems to be uncontroversial, especially since John Burge himself has had trial and is facing a sentence. But nonetheless, it seems like to be going deeper than just John Burge. A problem could still be manifest, even if, you know, the best case scenario for John Burge could be manifest. Go ahead.
My name is Mark Clements, and I spent 28 years in prison as a result of cops that worked under John Burge, and I was tortured at the age of 16. Of course, this goes beyond just John Burge. There were a ring of approximately 64 different detectives that worked under the command of John Burge and beat suspects at Area 2 and 3 violent crime units where he was the commander. John Burge was an individual that has only been accused actually in 10 different episodes of beating people, but he commanded the beatings in many of these cases. And that is why John Burge is faced with perjury and obstruction of justice for lying about these tortures and covering them up. This is corruption at its core that stretches all the way from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to the Mayor's Office. And this is one thing that many people in society fail to realize is that there are still 23 men, including Mr. Gerald Reed, that remains incarcerated, that has never been given a hearing on their claims of torture. A special prosecutor in July of 2006 ruled in a report that tortures at Area 2 and 3 was academic, meaning it was so widely spread within those two police stations. It's amazing that these people still remain incarcerated today.
So clearly there is a systemic issue regarding, you can certainly point to, I guess, the political faction about this. Authorities in local government and local police who, for basically abusing the power that they hold in public trust to ostensibly obey the law, keep the peace, things like that. But nonetheless, have been now implicated, and now seems to be in a system, and we're seeing now, and probably have for a while, a systemic issue regarding abuse of their power and in the application of torture of citizens. One thing I'd like to note is, and I'd like your thoughts on this and anyone else's, the dimension of race in regards to this. It would seem to me, although you would probably see, for example, black police officers, it seems like that the command about this, both within the police hierarchy and within local government, are predominantly, maybe exclusively white. And it seems to me, as far as I know about this, and I'm open to correction on this, that nearly all of those, perhaps all of those who have been affected with regarding police torture are not white. Perhaps black, some African American, there may be some whites. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, well, first of all, John Burge and his detectives only beat African American and Latino suspects. These were poor men that come from crime-ridden communities, and it allowed where that his operation of torture was able to continue in the city of Chicago for over 21 years from 1972 until 1993 under Burge's command. The problem of this is it's not told enough how much racism played effect in this. John Burge, every suspect that they beat and tortured, they call them names such as nigger, little nigger MF. They beat individuals with phone books. They grabbed their genitals and squeezed them. They threw some of them out of windows. They put the heads of some of them in toilet stools. They used cattle prongs to stick into some men's rectums. So this goes beyond racism. The problem that I have with all of this is that today our city council is made up with a fair share of African Americans, all except maybe one or two, that has remained silent about these tortures, which is costing the city of Chicago millions of dollars.
Why do you think that the African-American members of the city council have been silent? That they want to just keep their jobs or cushy positions, or is there something deeper involved?
Well, Mayor Daley, he built what is considered to be a machine. And if you don't go along the way that Mayor Daley wants you to go and do the things and say the things that he wants you to do, then you mysteriously end up indicted. If not indicted, you lose your automatic seat, or you're not given the contracts in your particular ward as you should. So, yes, they have remained silent. I blame African-American police officers for what took place because many of them knew. I blame African-American lawmakers because they knew. They kept this entire incidents that were being brought to them about these tortures, they kept this stuff quiet while men were languishing in prison and still languish in prison now today, costing taxpayers in the entire state of Illinois more than $1 million to just incarcerate these men. Mm-hmm. So I feel that we need to take a very hard look at these individuals and to come up with a solution, because no person in America should be tortured, mistreated, then locked up. This is torture upon torture that has occurred to poor African American and Latino people.
I could hear some skeptics of the situation that you've been outlining who've been saying, well, that's in the past. The, you know, Burge, as you had said, was in charge from 1972 to 1993. That's nearly two decades now. Things almost certainly must be better in the time since then. We're now approaching two decades of that. What do you say whenever you hear that kind of response? To, like, say that's back in the past?
Well, my name is Michelle. I'm the wife of Stanley Howard. And I'm also an activist with the campaign to end the death penalty, Jill John Burge Coalition, a lot of different organizations. Now, my husband is still in jail. He's been in jail for 26 years.
Mm-hmm. What is your husband's name?
Stanley Howard. Mm-hmm. He was tortured. He was picked up on November the 2nd, 1984. Okay, and he's been incarcerated since then. They put numerous of cases on him on that day. There was a case that was supposed to, and he was picked up for armed robbery of two police officers. And while he was there in the police station, they sent the scar on his leg while they were beating him. And then they talked about another incident that happened in 1982, 83, of a rape of this young lady in a robbery. So they put all of that on him. And today he's still fighting that case, even with the murder case that they put on him. They put another murder case on him. They put one murder case on him. But he was found innocent in 2003, am I correct? 2003, and he was pardoned by Governor Ryan, then Governor Ryan. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Governor Ryan also stated that the other cases that were on him looked just as tainted as that one did.
Yes.
Now, for people to say that it appears to be that everything is over with, it's still people right now today that's getting tortured by the police officers. I mean, my son, about 4 months ago, the police stomped him, beat his head in the concrete on 70th and Stewart this year, and then he disappeared. We couldn't find him for hours. Whereas when you be taken from 70th and Stewart, you're supposed to be taken to the police station on either Racine or another. They took him way on 51st Street, and I had to start throwing around names of people that they knew that were big in order for them to let me know where my son was. I called all the police stations. I went to police stations. They told me he's not here. He's not here. You need to go there. You need to go there. And when I started throwing around Gator's name and the campaign to end the death penalty, and I'm an activist, and I'm looking for my son, and nobody's telling me anything. I called some lawyers. They started calling the police, and then they told me where my son was.
When did all of this happen, this most recent
With my son, this was this past summer. In March.
Summer of 2010.
Yes.
Okay.
Mark called a press release, you know, and that's how I found out where my son was. It took all of that. I get telephone calls. I'm at work saying that they didn't stomp my son. His blood was everywhere, and nobody knew what happened.
How much time had elapsed between when you had last
heard
of him?
Maybe 5, 6, 7 hours. Something like that. And then all of a sudden they let him go.
After community pressure had been brought
yes.
to bear on him.
Yes. So, yep. And people are constantly, nobody's even mentioning Daly. our now mayor, the mayor that's mm-hmm. now, he was back then, he was the state's attorney
yes. mm-hmm.
at the time, and he knew of all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Nobody, even with Anita Alvarez, nobody even is mentioning her. It's like she is just not in none of this. And she knew because she is on papers, documents of Stanley Howard, which is my husband, saying about these attorneys that called the OPS office and told them not to investigate his torture claim.
Anita Alvarez being the current state's attorney.
Yes.
Office holder. Mm-hmm.
Her name is on that document saying that they are innocent. They hear nothing. But when you call the OPS office, they have to take your name down, the date and the time that you called. Mm-hmm. So he has both of those state's attorneys' names, and her name is on that document also. So nobody's even mentioning her name. It's like she's getting less pressure than anybody, her and Damon, which I believe that both of them should step up and take the blame for what they had part in.
Mayor Daley has announced that he is not running for another term. He is basically stepping down. He is stepping down from office. Nevertheless, it can
of course,
be,
you
it
know,
can,
Burge yeah. is being sentenced.
Right, right. That's what I'm getting at, actually, mm-hmm. is that, and in fact, you found this with Governor Ryan, who nonetheless faced charges regarding other crimes that he had done mm-hmm. after he had left office during the mm-hmm. time when he had been in office. That the fact that Mayor Daley won't be in a position of power doesn't necessarily exempt him from the kinds of things for which one can argue, probably convincingly, that he's played some role in. So I guess my question is, I guess what hopes, but also what do you think should happen with regards to Mayor Daley when he leaves office regarding this entire suite of affairs and the implication of his involvement therein?
Maybe they ought to indict him also. This is what I mean. It took them all these years to finally indict Burge.
Yes.
It took all this time, even though he retired or got fired or whatever it was in 1990 or 93, whatever year it was, mm-hmm. because of the marks that was left on Andrew Wilson, rest his soul. He died a few years ago mm-hmm. in the penitentiary. You know, although him and his brother did shoot cops at that time, but it did not give them the right to torture them. They put alligator clips on his ears, on his nose, on his chest, and had him handcuffed to a radiator. And every time they electroshocked him, his chest went up against the radiator. He had all those marks. That was the mistake that they made. They left marks on him where they didn't leave marks on other victims, other torture victims.
Yes.
Just like my husband, they put a typewriter cover over his head after the fact that they put a garbage bag over his head and tried to suffocate him, and he bit a hole in it. So they came back in the room with a typewriter cover and smothered him, you know, until he passed out, and they kicked and beat him and beat him with telephone books, where it didn't leave a lot of bruises. Whereas with Andrew Wilson, it was something different. Mm-hmm. They left a lot of marks on him, so it was nothing that they can say that he got the mark. They said he got the marks while he was in jail, that he must have hit a fight while he was in prison in order for him to get those marks.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.